This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Joe Miller of Central Illinois Precision Shooting says it's really hard to find the middle on gun control.
The media is full of the extremes. People are listening, but they're not hearing. And I don't have an answer for it.
GLT's Ryan Denham also talks with young shooters about what they find fulfilling in using guns. Plus, ISU Galleries director Barry Blinderman is stepping down after decades of helping shape the Twin Cities art scene. Laura Kennedy has more. And John Norton talks with the Poster Children, out with a new album after more than a decade away for parenting. That and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Thousands of young people have done the impossible this spring, moved the needle in the national debate over gun control. High schoolers walked out in droves across the country after the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting in Florida. They're demanding tighter restrictions on assault-style weapons and minimum ages for gun purchases, among other measures. For other kids, guns aren't something to be feared, though. They're a sport, a family tradition, something fun. GLT's Ryan Denham speaks with some young competitive shooters. Their parents and their coaches.
It sounds impossible. Pick up a rifle, aim it at a target 33 feet away, and try to hit a bullseye the size of a period in a 12-point Times New Roman font. 17-year-old Jaden Thompson can do it. The Normal West student is among the best young shooters in the country. She spends hours and hours at the range. Her coach calls her a range rat. There are other sacrifices, too.
If you eat anything sugary or full of caffeine, it will affect your shooting, and it starts making your heart rate faster, and you don't want a faster heart rate when you're shooting. I also have to take physical training into account, so you have to do a lot of cardio and core strength.
The Bloomington girl says she loves what shooting demands of her.
And it's just you when you're on the gun. It's no one else. So it's about very extreme focus, which I really enjoy.
High schoolers across the country, including in Bloomington Normal, have rallied for more gun control since the February 14th shooting in Parkland, Florida.
Change!
When do we want it?
Now!
What do we want?
Change!
When do we want it?
Now!
States like Florida have responded with tighter gun restrictions, and Illinois is considering the same. While her peers at Normal West and other schools have planned walkouts and made protest signs, Jaden has been at the range practicing. She's getting ready for June's USA Shooting Rifle and Pistol National Championships in Fort Benning, Georgia. Jaden agrees that there are dangerous people who shouldn't be allowed to have a gun, but she says policymakers should focus more on those troubled individuals, not on the guns themselves. She wants more people to learn about gun safety.
It's not the gun that pulls the trigger, so you can't really blame any of these things on the guns. So it's more people.
Jaden started shooting around age 13, just before 8th grade. That's typical for kids from gun families like Jaden, whose relatives are avid hunters. A Pew Research Center study shows that those who grew up around guns usually fire their first one around 14. Jaden is one of many young shooters who take lessons through Central Illinois Precision Shooters, or SIPS, as they call it. SIPS has a range next to Darnell's, about 15 minutes west of Bloomington Normal. I visited with several SIPS coaches, students, and parents on a recent weeknight.
Oh, that was my rough one.
No, you hit a good one, and
so
you winged
that.
But
the wrist shot is real tight.
I asked what they thought of the national post-Parkland debate over guns, how young people around the same age could see things so differently on guns. They say there's a gap of understanding between gun enthusiasts and opponents. They said legal gun owners, especially competitive shooters, prioritize gun safety first and foremost, and are not the cause of America's gun violence problem. They want to see more gun opponents come to the range and see what it's like. They say their defense of gun culture is not just about the Second Amendment, and that there's more room in the middle of the gun debate than we think. That's according to Joe Miller, the head coach at SIPS.
The media is full of the extremes. and people are listening, but they're not hearing. And I don't have an answer for it. I truly don't.
Miller says that Illinois' gun laws are restrictive enough that they would have stopped someone like the Florida shooter before he killed 17 people. But Miller is not opposed to all new gun measures. He said he'd like to see more states reporting information into the National Instant Criminal Background Check System to improve the quality of checks. He said he'd like to see harsher penalties for those caught with a weapon without a FOID card. In Illinois, you must be at least 18 years old to legally purchase a long gun and at least 21 to buy a handgun. But there are exceptions. A minor can apply for a FOID card with a parent or legal guardian sponsor. For many adults who own guns, exposure to guns happened at an early age. According to the Pew study, about two-thirds of current gun owners say there were guns in their household growing up, and 76% report that they first fired a gun before they were 18. Children as young as 8 begin learning to shoot through 4-H programs. That's according to Kurt Willoughby of Danvers, who teaches at SIPS and through 4-H. So where does an 8-year-old start?
We start them off on a T200 Sporter air rifle. It's a smaller, lighter rifle. The kids can hold it for the most part. They start them off in prone position, and they'll shoot there for a while. If some of the littler kids, if they can't hold it, we have benches, or we'll put them on tables, on sandbags, so they can hold it. They'll learn sight picture, sight alignment, trigger control, and breathing.
Air rifles, by the way, are different than traditional firearms. They typically shoot pellets using compressed air or other gases. Coach Willoughby says he loves teaching kids because he gets to see his students mature as they get better.
That's our paydays, watching them become responsible young people. I mean, it's a great feeling to see someone come in that looks at their shoes, won't talk to you. A year later, they're talking to crowds, they're talking to people about shooting sports. You know, we teach them a lot of life skills, and we watch them change and say it's a great feeling that we can help somebody.
That's what happened with 15-year-old Ty Scher from Farmer City. He shot his first gun by age 8. Here's Coach Miller talking about Ty.
He was quiet, and I mean, you could spell quiet with a capital Q, because he just, we joke, you ask him a question or you say something to him and he'd shrug his shoulders. I think he did not use a complete sentence in communicating with me for 6 months.
Like other kids, Ty tried team sports like baseball, basketball, and soccer. Here's his mother, Vanessa.
But when he came here for the first time, I saw excitement, and I hadn't seen that in the previous sports. So that was a positive sign. And then as we kept going with it, I saw him become more assertive. He would problem solve, which as a parent was nice to see. That was very hard for him. A lot of times he would just miss out on things or, you know, not get the help he needed because he was too shy to ask. And now, in a match just the other day, he actually challenged a shot that he thought should have been, that was scored incorrectly. And I thought for sure he would let it go and just take the hit, and he didn't. So that was an accomplishment, in my opinion, as a mother.
Ty says he likes the problem-solving nature of the sport, figuring out, for example, that the setting on his front sight was a little too small during a recent practice, which was making his shots not as tightly grouped as he'd like them. So he opened it up a bit and fixed it.
I like the challenge. You learn a lot about yourself.
Ty says he thinks there's a lack of awareness about the shooting sports that may unfairly shape public opinion on guns. He said he thinks there's a way to deal with gun violence in the U.S. without harming his sport.
When I'm here, I don't really worry about it that much. To me, everybody's got their opinions.
Ty's mother says she's not worried about having her son so engrossed in gun culture. Quite the opposite.
I look at my two boys. I have two boys. I look at the skills and the knowledge and the safety that they have learned in this sport. And I don't fear that they would ever try to do harm to someone with their gun, with their rifle, just because they have respect for it and respect for what it can do. So I am actually grateful for that.
To be sure, gun control advocates are not trying to take away air rifles or stop teenagers like Jaden and Ty from shooting in competitions. But the competitive shooters at SIPS certainly sense the gun debate moving in. Joe Miller has worked for years with high schoolers. What does he think of all the young people rallying for more gun control?
My first reaction is, and having talked to some of those kids, they really don't know what they're talking about. They see the evil, and it is evil, in the gun culture. But they've never really sat down with a shooter or they've never participated in it to see what the interest is.
Gun opponents have taken aim at AR-15 assault-style rifles, which were largely banned until 2004. An AR-15-style rifle like the one used in Parkland isn't Jaden's preferred gun, but she has shot one before in competition. She says it's really fun.
And if you're taking those guns out of there, it's taking a sport away from people. And I don't think a lot of people think that way. It's kind of like trying to ban football. You're banning an AR-15, which is a sport for some people.
Coach Willoughby says shooting programs like his connect with young people in a way that might prevent future violence.
From a lot of the shootings, the biggest thing is they don't have a family life, or it's a poor family life. You know, so here we try to create a family life, whether or not they have it at home or not, they have it here. They know this is a safe place. They can come talk to us about anything. And all the coaches here will try to fix anything that we can for them.
Willoughby's own daughter, Chandra, got into shooting after attending an NRA camp at Darnell's around age 9. Here's her mother, Vanessa.
People I worked with were like, you're crazy for letting your child go and stay at a camp and learn all this stuff. And I said, you know, the number one thing they learn is safety.
Chandra is now 15. She's also a flute player in the school band.
She's in control, whether it be her flute or her rifle. It's her. You know, mom and dad's not helping. Coach isn't helping. You're in charge. And I just see the confidence level. She's going to be a freshman this fall, and her confidence level has just skyrocketed.
Asked if there was room for compromise on guns, Coach Willoughby says he'd like to think so.
The biggest fear is if you give them an inch, they'll take a foot.
The national debate over guns is sure to flare again when the next mass shooting inevitably happens. As we search for the middle on this issue, people like those we found at Central Illinois Precision Shooters would be those you'd want at the table. I'm Ryan Denham.
In the 2 weeks since Ryan visited Central Illinois Precision Shooters, another school shooting claimed the lives of 8 students and 2 teachers at a high school in Santa Fe, Texas, and a shooting at a Dixon, Illinois high school resulted in the wounding of the shooter.
Support for GLT comes from Luther Oaks, with an established reputation in providing assisted living. Immediate availability with a simple monthly rental program. Moving assistance available by calling 309-557-8000 or visiting lutheroaks.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. In just a few minutes, saying goodbye to a man of the arts in the Twin Cities. Women who say a powerhouse volleyball coach in Aurora allegedly raped and sexually assaulted them when they were minors in the 1980s are telling their stories to an Illinois Senate committee. They're asking lawmakers to consider changes in hopes of preventing such abuse in the future. IPR's Daisy Contreras has more.
Julie Romeas joined Sports Performance Volleyball Club when she was 16 years old. It was a year later when she says her coach Rick Butler first raped her.
With a smug smile on his face that I still can't get out of my mind, he said, "I'm the first one. Now you'll have to compare everyone after me to me."
She claims Butler used isolation and fear tactics to manipulate her and believed he would end her promising volleyball career if she defied him. Butler has overseen a pipeline for young volleyball talent to some major universities. Since club sport organizations like Sports Performance are not affiliated with a school or university, they do not fall under the same mandatory reporting requirements for sexual misconduct. Romeo says this needs to change.
Some other coaches knew and did nothing. They were not mandated to report this, after all. An ex-teammate of mine and an ex-Sports Performance coach both tried to contact USA Volleyball and got no responses.
The revelations involving Rick Butler got more attention after the case of Larry Nassar, the doctor who worked with USA Gymnastics. He's been sentenced to prison after more than 250 people came forward to accuse him of molestation. Michigan State University had ties to both men. Romeas and the other Butler accusers came forward in the 90s. They claim Butler was not prosecuted because of the statute of limitation, meaning legal deadlines had already passed. Romeas and the other accusers have also asked for a database that would keep track of coaches kicked out of the sport because of sexual assault. Since early this year, Butler has been banned from USA Volleyball and other athletic organizations. But Romeas claims he currently still coaches minors privately. Polly Poskin is a victim's advocate with the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Poskin says organizations can choose to publish a list of banned coaches or members, but listing them for possible sexual assault could raise concerns of defamation or libel.
If you don't have some record, some way, somehow, how then could a person know about the safety concerns regarding her coach?
Some athletic organizations have instead formed groups to prevent this type of harassment. USA Volleyball is part of a new initiative called Safe Sport. According to the Team USA website, it provides athletic clubs with prevention techniques to end emotional and physical abuse in sports. But in Illinois, some lawmakers say this needs to go further. Members of the Illinois Senate Sexual Discrimination and Harassment Awareness and Prevention Task Force, where Romeo's and other survivors testified, say no legislation has been filed pertaining specifically to sexual harassment in youth sports. The task force has three measures they are hoping to pass this session, but they all deal primarily with legislative ethics. Melinda Bush, a Grace Lake Democrat, is a task force co-chair. She says other proposals that deal with sexual harassment and assault in a broader scope are forthcoming.
But we're trying to make sure that there are laws in place so that if sexual harassment takes place, you know, A, where to go, that there's a process in place, and that these allegations are dealt with seriously.
Rick Butler's lawyer has not commented, citing a pending lawsuit. But in the 90s, during a hearing with USA Volleyball, a published report indicated Butler admitted to having sex with three of his accusers. But he claimed they were 18 or older at the time, and the sex was consensual. Julie Romeus, one of the Butler accusers, says her testimony in front of the Illinois Senate Task Force wasn't just about Butler. She says it's a part of a widespread problem in youth sports that needs addressed.
I'm telling my story because, unfortunately, I think it's another child's story. And I'm hoping we can learn from it and prevent it from happening to the next child.
I'm Daisy Contreras.
This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from the University of Illinois system. Three universities, one system. Together, the three universities in Urbana-Champaign, Chicago, and Springfield have a goal of providing transformative education and breakthrough research. Altogether extraordinary. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, to water or not to water your lawn? That is the question with GLT's Grow. After 31 years guiding the university galleries, the director is heading into retirement. Barry Blinderman made the leap from the New York art scene to Illinois State University in the 80s, and in the years that followed, he made bold moves as a curator and helped to create a cultural bridge between the university and the Bloomington Normal community. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
From skyscraper canyons to open prairie, Barry Blinderman left the ultimate urban landscape in New York City to work under the forever sky of central Illinois, where his creative vision changed the artistic landscape of his new home. In 1987, Blinderman was director of a private gallery in New York City when the desire for more, a chance to publish and to teach, brought him to Illinois State University as director of the university galleries. And while he was excited for the new opportunity, the change was a bit of a shock to his system.
I was flabbergasted just landing with a puddle jumper in Peoria and going through frozen soybean fields and thinking, oh no, what have I done? My New York friends are right. This is a wilderness out here. I can't possibly survive. Well, at least if it had been a wilderness and not farmland, maybe it would have been better. But
the farmland freaked you out.
Just the flatness and the desolation of the winter definitely put a damper on my enthusiasm.
And how long did that last?
Well, I kept the lease on my New York apartment for a year, I'll tell you that. What was amazing was the freedom and the support that I got from the School of Art, from the College of Fine Arts, from the university, from the president. I felt like we were able to accomplish whatever we wanted. And I say we, it's myself and a guard and a grad student at first. I immediately applied for grants and I was scared. I said, like, I've never applied for a grant before. How's this going to work? And I applied for a National Endowment grant, and we got it. And we got the next, and the one after that, and probably got about six in a row. This jump-started our publications program. And then once we had publications, we could sell publications. And that raised money for exhibitions. And then the exhibitions began to travel to other museums and galleries, which raised more money. So pretty soon, the fact that we were given so little money to fund the gallery's exhibition program was irrelevant because we were making our own money. I think I had a pretty good business model going.
What are some of the favorite shows that you've had here over the years?
I think the last real humdinger that I did was the Walter Robinson exhibition. Before that, the UFO show, other shows, the post-hypnotic exhibition that had to do with optical illusions in contemporary work. That one ended up traveling to Chicago and Texas, and that went to Atlanta and many other places. And then there are the ones that everybody mentions. I joke that, you know, Grant Wood, in terms of most people, did one painting, right? The American Gothic, the guy with the pitchfork and his wife. And I think sometimes my American Gothic is the David Voinarovich exhibition. Because no matter where you are, people say, oh yeah, Barry Blinderman, he did the Voinarovich exhibition. You know what? If I'm going to be known for something, I'll take it. That's a great thing to be known for.
As director of the gallery, you have an eye for art and for artists. How do you know where to shine the light in the art world? How do you spot the talent you know will go far and impact many?
Well, you know, I think that most curators would probably agree with me that it's largely intuitive. There's no formula. You can't hold a meter, a galvanometer or a radiation meter up to an artwork and where it will tell you that, yes, this is the kind of thing you should show. I think everybody has that kind of meter built into their head. If you looked through the many shows that I've organized over time, there's a lot of variety. I haven't stuck to figurative or abstract or conceptual or video or photography or painting. There's a mix. But I think I've always been attracted to works that have multi-layered meanings that go beyond the first shot, the kind of impact that knocks you off your feet. I like that. And so I like very strong images. Some of the exhibitions I've done have featured work that has bright colors or other things that are flashy, and others have been more laid back and contemplative.
So a few years ago, you made the move, the galleries made the move from the ISU campus right on the quad to this new location in Uptown. And that was a big move and could be construed as kind of risky. What are your feelings about now that it's happened and you seem to be being embraced by the community here in Uptown?
It's been a wonderful development in any possible measurable way. First of all, the space is delightful. We have 20-foot ceilings and state-of-the-art LED lighting supplemented by fluorescent. When people come here, I feel that they get a sense of the importance of what is being shown. I gave the architects models of New York galleries, Chelsea galleries. I even showed them pictures of the Pompidou in Paris because I wanted exposed duct work. I wanted to give it a kind of industrial look that would be quiet. It's all shades of gray, and that would allow the work to really, to quote your term, shine. At first, when the dean told me about this opportunity, I was really scared because at the time we thought we were getting a new CVA. And I thought, well, I want to stick around here with my cohort. If we move, maybe they won't even come out here. And it turned out to be incredible. Our attendance has gone up. People can come right off the train. Some people think this is the train station. They come in with their suitcases. Artists are more likely to come down from Chicago now because they can just take the train for the day, walk 100 yards, and they're in the gallery. I can't tell you how pleasant it is to work here. Every afternoon, I thank my lucky stars for being able to look out the windows facing west. In my view is the Waterson Towers and watch the sunset. It's extraordinary. It's the best place to work, and my staff and I are feel very lucky to be here.
And yet you're retiring. Why so?
Well, it was hard to give up, I'll tell you. I really wanted to leave at the top of my game, and you never know. I had often thought, well, you know, there could be something worse than just working till you die on this job. But I really did a lot of thinking, but I have to say I was scared, really scared to find out who I was when I wasn't wearing the director's hat. And I booted myself out. I really kicked myself out. I was certain that I probably had made a horrible mistake and was thinking about going back and taking it back for about a day or so. Then over the period of, it was just March, over the period of about 3 weeks, 4 weeks, it started settling in that, hey, I'm an adventurous soul. I'm not gonna sit around drinking beer and eating Keebler cookies and binge watching TV.
That's my retirement plan. Hey, don't knock it.
I'm gonna do that for a couple of years. But after that, I got plans. Today I was looking on the internet about Costa Rica because everybody's making such a big fuss about that. I want to, I'm not moving. This will be my home base for now. But I definitely want to escape the winter. If I'm bored, I'm sure I can find something to do.
How about music? You're a man who loves to make music.
Well, I will be doing that. Thank you. I have a lot of songs that I've written through the years that I've not recorded yet. So I want to start probably with the ones that I have. But meanwhile, I think that given the time and energy, I'll have the inspiration to write new material. And there are a lot of musicians around here that I'd like to collaborate with. I have friends in other places. It's real easy to collaborate these days. You just send files back and forth on Dropbox. So I don't know if I'll want to perform, but I definitely want to record. I want to write and record music. I've gotten a lot of satisfaction out of that. I do want to put a plug in for my incredible staff here, Kendra Pates and Jason Judd and Gabe Johnson. I think that the gallery is in really exciting and talented and capable hands. I think they're doing an extraordinary job.
That's Barry Blinderman, director of the University Galleries in Uptown Normal. He's retiring on June 30th after 31 years on the job. His one regret is leaving behind the students he enjoyed mentoring. I'm Laura Kennedy.
As Blinderman heads off into a musical direction, let's listen to his song, Everybody Asks Me, right after this.
The seasons have a way of creeping up on us. Holiday shopping and spring planting can be hurried. But summer, that's a time to relax. Make the GLT Summer Concert your first day of summer. Daughter of blues legend Johnny Copeland, Shamika Copeland, will belt out the blues and R&B to close out the show.
Jesus just left Chicago.
Dan Hubbard and Sammy Miller and the Congregation also on stage as Seth Q presents the GLT Summer Concert June 9th. Details at WGLT.org.
Everybody asks me what I'm gonna do without you. I don't think I really know. I don't think I really know. Something tells me I still need you. Stop believing we've got nothing left to lose. We can start it all anew. If love's arrived,
you can find Everybody Asks Me by Barry Blinderman and other tunes by Blinderman on YouTube and iTunes. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. If you want a healthy yard, you've got to drag out the old sprinkler now and then to give your landscape a drink. Or do you? Patrick Murphy has more in this edition of GLT's Grow.
Water, water everywhere, but are you getting the most out of it for your plants? I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field. From the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum, it's Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
Hi, Laura.
And today we're talking about watering, or even not watering, too, if you choose to do that. So what's the secret to good watering?
Well, I think the beginning of the secret to good watering is having a clearest of understanding of how plants take up their water.
Because they don't all do it in a blanket kind of a way.
They don't. So along those lines, Laura, unless you're growing redwood trees out on the West Coast, your plants are taking up their water through their roots.
Okay.
Through the roots, the parts that you can't see that are in the earth. So now that I've said that, we can have a game with our imagination where we think of all the sprinklers that we ran through when we were kids.
Oh, yeah.
Let's start with the fan sprinkler. We all know the fan sprinkler
that goes
raises
back
up and swings back and forth.
Yeah.
You can have it do a swing all the way from the left to the right or stop in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great sprinkler.
Oh, good.
For playing in the water.
Oh.
Playing in the water. I got you. No, it's a good sprinkler.
Okay.
But here's the risk with that sprinkler, if there's such a thing. Most of the water doesn't end up down where the plant roots are.
It evaporates?
It does, and it gets caught on the leaf blades. And in watering in the high sun hours, so 10 a.m. or later, a lot of that water is suspended on the leaves, on the foliage.
Right.
Grass is pretty close to the ground, so the water just runs down the blade and finds its way to the ground where the roots are. But if there's any wind at all, as much as 50% of that water that's in the air is gone before the largest droplets even make it to the ground.
Wow.
That's mind-blowing to me.
Yeah.
So I can also remember running through the water cannon that shot a big blast. It was similar to an oscillating sprinkler.
You mean the one that goes...
That's an oscillating sprinkler.
Right.
This one is more like chuck, 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 and it has a string and it pulls it across the yard, and sometimes they look like little tractors.
Yeah, they do.
They throw a lot of water, and they throw it parallel to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And they oftentimes use a mechanism that runs off of the water's pressure to have this device creep along a string or a cord so that you cover the area that you're irrigating. They throw lots of water and heavy droplets close to the ground. But you have to move this one, and there's a lot involved in setting it up and repositioning it.
You know,
so you'd want to have it drive across an area. And that's a real effective one because all that water is getting dumped close to the ground, and there's not a lot of spritzing. It's just a stream of water and big fat droplets. So you get over 70% of that water is going to the ground. It makes it to the ground. So if it is watering grass, hits the grass first, the sun and the wind take their share,
mm-hmm.
and then what's left goes to the ground. That's one of the most effective ways to throw water on the ground. But then let's go back to the oscillator. It's kind of a little of both. That one.
The marimba section.
You get the,
that's what I call
you
it.
You get the spritzing marimba.
Uh-huh.
And that water is oftentimes lost unless it's captured by other plants that are close by.
Okay.
Okay, so if you set that sprinkler up so that the little spritz is hitting the flower bed before the bigger spray reaches out into the lawn, you're kind of making the best out of that situation.
Well, what about I've got a sprinkler that is kind of like an octopus that has, you know, metal arms that come out. And there's like about six or seven of them, and it just sort of whirls around, not very fast.
Yeah.
And then it just sort of tosses the water out, but not very high.
You know, I bet you that sprinkler might actually work better at low pressure than it does at high pressure because I keep mentioning the size of the droplets. The big, heavy, fat droplets, they make it to the ground with little loss. The spritzing and the spraying and the mist, a lot of that is lost, even on days when it's not windy, because the sun burns it up quickly.
Right.
And so say you got a Japanese maple, a very common ornamental plant, and you're irrigating with the spritzing and the mists and stuff like that, and some of that water is left on the foliage noon or later. The sun can damage those plants by little magnifications of the sunlight burning a hole through the leaf. So there is a hazard in many cases to irrigating by soaking the foliage down rather than irrigating to soak the ground.
Okay, you're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty or wet. And this week we're talking about watering. But what about if you think, you know what, I feel like I'm just sort of throwing money away by watering. Maybe I'd like to re-landscape my yard so that watering is not something I have to worry about.
Well, I think that falls into a category of water conservation landscaping, and that there is a term for that. It's called xeriscaping.
Mm-hmm.
Xeriscaping is really common in the markets of Arizona and Texas and New Mexico and places where it's deserty. but it certainly has a place in any other location. It could be right here in the Midwest. What's neat about xeriscaping is it oftentimes uses other natural components besides the plants to decorate the surface. Those components are usually rocks and stones and boulders.
Oh, yeah, like maybe like beach glass kind of thing.
Beach glass, great idea, love that. I've also seen driftwood and manufactured log jams incorporated into the stones mm-hmm. to kind of create steps and terracing. The beauty of xeriscaping is that it actually creates a little bit of water of its own.
Oh,
and it
really?
Makes the best use of its own water. So xeriscaping might find a low spot in the landscape or a spot where water runs from a downspout into another distant location, and the xeriscape would find that as the bottom, so that's where some water does go. And that landscape is actually very pretty when there is some water there because it holds that water in this little catch that could be in the form of an artificial pool or an artificial brook or stream or a slough, if you will. And because there are so many rocks and heavy things in these xeriscape landscapes, they usually rest on the earth on top of fabric.
Okay, so then we don't have to worry about weeds coming through and all that.
That it's a huge help with the weeds, but it also prevents the stones from just sinking into the earth.
Good point.
Yeah, because they will, because there will be some moisture there. And there's also going to be times that you need to walk through there and clear out leaves. And
don't do it barefoot.
Right, don't do it barefoot. And that'll push the stones down. The fabric, the landscaping fabrics that are available nowadays are so advanced that they even have one-way directional fabric.
Wow.
Water goes down, but it won't come back up. And that's really good for xeriscaping. But you could xeriscape with heavy 4 to 8 mil plastic as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because the stones laying on top of the barrier, they cover the ground. So that ground is protected from the sunlight. And it's insulated from the radiant heat because rocks conduct heat, but they also give it off on the upside, their upside. That area underneath of the fabric or plastic is going to be cool. It's going to hold water for the longest amount of time. And as we've said on Grow many times, fine plants love the consistency of cool, moist soil.
Yep.
Weeds hate it. Weeds love extremes. So you're kind of building a little camp for water to hang around. And then when you're selecting the plants for your xeriscaping, you want to select them and position them in a way that they capture as much of that water that's being held by the xeriscape.
Great, great plan. I love that idea.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Murph. Now, next week on GLT's Grow, we're going to be using plants to create landscape forms, like creek beds, for
or
example.
Berms.
Or berms. So it could be very instructive, and we'd love to hear from you. If you have a gardening question, well, send it to us. It's wglt.org/grow.
You can subscribe to the GLT Grow podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The now Bloomington-based punk rock quartet Poster Children, that recorded on Warner Reprise Records in the 1990s, has released its first album in 14 years. Band leaders and husband and wife Rick Valentin and Rose Marshak say children and further pursuing higher education put a damper on recording, but they say they're always creating. Both are now arts technology professors at Illinois State University. With children now old enough to fend for themselves, they say it was time to write and record a new Poster Children album. Marshak and Valentin sat down with John Norton in the GLT studio to talk about the new album, Grand Bargain. Valentin says getting back into the studio was like getting back on a bicycle, but the problem was finding the opportunity to do it.
Now that everyone's got jobs and family and everything like that, we can't say, oh, we're going to spend 12 hours and hope a song pops out.
Hey, guys, let's go up into the attic and play some more. Right. Like, that's what, you know, how Daisy Chain Reaction was written, right? You know,
yeah,
hey,
a lot of it.
Hey,
yeah.
There's nothing on TV. Let's go upstairs and write some more songs.
Yeah, and this was a little different. So my brother Jim and I, the guitarist of the band, had sketches of ideas, and then we would play together and work out ideas. And then Rose would join us and work out ideas, and then we'd bring them to the drummer. Because what would happen in the past, actually, honestly, is sometimes like a guitar player would bring in a riff, and then the guitar players would sit there working out something, and Rose and Matt, bass player and drummer, would just get frustrated with us because they wanted to.
I know, but this is not how Grand Bargain was written.
That's the thing, the first song. And so the first song on the album, Grand Bargain, is like the way we used to write songs, where it was just like it kind of just popped up in practice. So Rose and Matt just started playing, and then Jim and I started playing guitars over it, and it became a song.
So let's play a little bit of it right now then, okay?
Yeah. America held hostage day one. A lot of folks woke up without power this morning. It's every man for himself and every woman at 70% of the going rate.
Yeah, now this is something else. This is a pummeling of the Trump administration, of America, a defense of education and women's rights. You've never been shy about expressing your political beliefs on record. You wear your politics on your sleeve often, but is this time a little bit different as well?
I feel like I've always been pretty upset.
It's no different at all.
Pretty upset, is that what you said?
Yeah. And even in eras where maybe as a progressive you're supposed to be happy, I might have been a little more angry too. So it's, I think what I found is that I get upset about stuff politically, I write songs about it, and then if we enter an era where I'm less upset politically, I'll write songs about relationships or something, maybe, right? And lyrics, I should say lyrics, right? So I write the lyrics, I don't write the music, right? We all write the music.
And musically on this song, it sounds like it's a war.
No, I think I feel like I'm playing a war sometimes when I'm playing bass. I think Matt and I really enjoy playing together and making it into some sort of a battle, I think. And it's I'm not sure who we're battling.
Sounds like bombs are going off and just, it's so intense.
Yeah, and I think that's characteristic of the songs that start with bass and drums. So they're obviously more rhythmic. Rose is like classic punk rock, right? Where it's like aggression. And she's working out her aggression, right?
Yes.
Are you an angry person, Rose?
No, yeah. I on the stage, yeah. I come off with black and blue marks a lot. I was just rereading my tour diaries, and I'm reading where I'm covered with black and blue marks.
That was the thing about this record, is we were thinking about these songs as live songs too, right? So we weren't planning on doing a produced record this time. We were planning on doing a live record like our older records, where you go into the studio and play your live set and capture that. And so I think that lends itself to more aggressive, angry kind of songs, and just the improvisation thing, where it's just like, hey, drums and bass are going, you know, it winds up being intense and angry.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton with Rick Valentin and Rose Marshak of Poster Children. Their brand new album is out. It's called The Grand Bargain. Let's go to another song on the album. There's something a little bit different. Hippie Hill.
Hippie Hills.
Set the brain, late class, bomb block, ambulance, principal, crowd of kids, broken arms, broken skin. That's the day that Simon Fair, the swing set.
And then this sounds more like nostalgia, back to the good old days, and you're kind of hinting at maybe they weren't such the good old days, right?
Right.
What was the trigger to put this song into your lyrically?
So when I was a kid, back in the early 70s, there was an undeveloped area in my neighborhood in Western Springs, and kids called it Hippie Hills, and so it was a place where we would ride our bikes and hang out, and there was an underpass, and, you know, you throw glass bottles and everything like that. And so...
So everything that's in the song.
Yeah, okay. Pretty much everything in the song.
You should say
so
where you grew up, though.
Western Springs, Illinois. So
like
the suburbs.
Very suburban area.
Undeveloped area, so it was almost like a nature preserve, but not really. No, it was like an empty lot, but much larger. So it's just remembering that time and also kind of taking an adult perspective, where it's like there were great things that happened, but also childhood is not all great stuff, right? It's, you know, people get hurt and
so do you remember happy childhoods, both of you?
It was mixed, you know. It was definitely great. And that's the thing I remember, is I remember summers being great and also being outside and everything like that. And so that's the one thing that I feel is missing when I look at my kids and other kids, is like you realize that they're not roaming around the neighborhoods wild for the whole summer with no supervision, you know, getting broken bones, you know, lighting things on fire. Who knows what's going on, right? None of that happens anymore. So I think that was a formative part of my life. But also, I was not the happiest kid either, you know?
All that freedom? You know, I didn't...
No. The freedom was not the problem. It was, you know, being a creative person, you know, it's tough, I think. Being an artsy kid or whatever you want to call it is never easy, or wasn't easy when at my age.
Oh yeah, you know, I haven't asked you. Have you seen the playgrounds, the free running playgrounds? You know, the where kids have got hammers and nails.
Yeah,
and
it's basically like an empty lot, like what you used to have.
Does that make you happy?
Yeah, and I think that's great.
So you grew up happy, Rose?
No, of course not. No.
Okay, well, to me, you guys both seem like very happy, normal people.
Yeah. So listen,
how do you get to be punk rockers with happy, normal childhoods? But you're thinking...
We were both very unhappy as children, and now, and through punk rock...
Are you snarking me, or are you serious?
No, I'm serious.
Okay,
and through punk rock, we discovered a way to be, and
yeah, I think
we're really
both,
happy now.
Outsiders. It's, and so this is the weird thing now, is like there's nerd culture...
Yeah.
Punk rock, or just weird music, all that kind of stuff. Being in orchestra, all that kind of stuff. Well, being in orchestra maybe is still a nerdy thing, but it's like a lot of nerd culture now is mainstream culture. But at the time, if you were watching Doctor Who, for instance, in the 70s, that was a way to limit the number of friends you had.
Scarf,
yeah,
right?
It was basically like, okay, I can only talk to 5 people about Doctor Who, and I can't talk to within earshot of anyone else, or we'll all get beat up, right?
That's Rose Marshak, along with Rick Valentin. Yes, they're married. They're also in the band Poster Children with a brand new album called Grand Bargain. Rick, I wrote to you the other night how I couldn't stop listening to Devil and the Gun on this album. And it's, you know, it's a complicated political issue. What were the conversations like on how you wanted to approach this topic in on this album?
Ooh, I don't think I consulted with anyone in the band.
No, yeah.
I just wrote the words.
Singing.
That's when it comes to the lyrics, I kind of just take the lead on that.
Then we all sit there and go, "Oh my God, he's such a good lyricist." I mean, I love your lyrics.
The band is an emotional release, and I'm really frustrated with the situation around guns in our country. And I have kids, who are in public schools. Or just in school, right? And so seeing this happen over and over and over again and nothing changing. And so this song could have been written 14 years ago.
But it was written, a year or two ago?
A year ago. Yeah, 2 years ago.
So way before Parkland even.
Yeah, that's the biggest frustration is it keeps happening, these mass shootings. And you say it's a political situation. And I guess that's what's frustrating is it's become a political situation. To me, it's just a human situation where it's like if this amount of violence is happening, you should do something about it. And it shouldn't be about politics. It should be about solving the problem.
Comes to work, your church or school. He gets a pass because it looks like you. Then it takes everyone away. Leaves us here to pick up the chain.
Not only are the lyrics so powerful, the music is so powerful in this one, and even when you were screaming on the album and toward the end of the song, and then that big chord change, was it 2/3, 3/4 of the way? It just, wow, my heart just jumped up when I heard it the first time.
No, we were playing, I remember playing this live for the first couple of times. And we haven't played these songs live a lot, and I remember thinking, oh, this is another one of those really powerful songs that I can try to dig a hole in the ground into, you know. I know we were all, I didn't realize it while we were writing it together either.
So let's do one more song.
Okay.
And I can tell by the look on Rick's face that he'd rather do with a different one, but Better Place.
All of my friends think you are great. They think I made a big mistake.
you, is it because, like, Steve Albini a lot of times will say, oh, you sound like Fred Schneider, and then he gets all upset, and Steve Albini
from the
is B-52.
Like... Right.
You don't take that as a compliment.
No, I know.
Well, I hear it a lot. So there was one time where I worked a lot on my vocals on one record, and the guy mastering it said, wow, you're doing more of the Fred Schneider thing on this record. It was like the exact opposite of what I wanted to hear. It was like I was intentionally...
And Steve was like in awe of you.
Yeah, so there are people who love that type of vocalist.
So you have a better liking to this song, Rose, than...
Yeah, I love this song. It's a breakup song, Rick said, but he's breaking up with...
Facebook. Yeah, so it's my social media breakup song. So instead of writing a song, because it's hard for me to write breakup songs when I'm in the band with somebody...
With your wife.
Yeah, with my wife.
Of 22 years.
22 years.
That I've heard, by the way...
32 years we've been together.
Happy anniversary, by the way.
Thank
I just found
you.
Out, was it last week as we're speaking?
It was the day the record came out.
Well, it's great to have you guys in here again. Rose Marshak, Rick Valentin, Poster Children, congrats on the new album. Happy anniversary to you.
Thank you.
And
thanks
for coming in.
Thanks, Chuck.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University's School of Communication. I'm Charlie Schlenker.